And we're back for another episode of Startup Hustle, a podcast for entrepreneurs by entrepreneurs. If you want to start, own, or build a business, then you're in the right place. We bring you the real truth about what it's like to take something from concept to launch. From growth, innovation, experience, failing, or winning big, we've got you covered. So let's get down to business with another episode of Startup Hustle, brought to you by Fullscale.io.
And we're back for another episode of the Startup Hustle. This is your host, Matt Watson. Today, excited to be joined by the founder and CEO of Asset Panda, Rex Curzius, who has started and done a bunch of different things in his career. We'll probably talk about a few of them today, but going to talk mostly today about creating a global SaaS company. I did that in my past as well. And it's, you know, a lot of people who are starting a software company don't realize that there's an international market out there, but it creates its own set of problems, which I'm sure Rex and I will talk a lot about today. Before we get it started, I do want to remind you that today's episode is brought to you by Fullscale, which is my company. We have over 300 software developers in the Philippines, which have worked for over hundreds of other tech companies, doing front-end work, back-end work, mobile, QA, whatever kind of software development help you need. You can check us out at fullscale.io. Rex, how are you doing today, man?
I'm great. Thank you. Thanks for having me, Matt.
So would you describe yourself as a serial entrepreneur?
I am. Yeah, I've started, built, and sold multiple companies throughout my career.
It's kind of a disease, isn't it? Like once you get it, like it doesn't go away.
It doesn't go away. And it's a unique skill set that I don't know if I wish upon most people, but yeah, you know it just as well as I do. Once it gets in your blood and your DNA, it's hard to do anything else.
Yeah, it's kind of a blessing and a curse. It's its own like superpower, but like you also can't shut it off. Like I'm always working, always thinking, always looking for problems, always trying to solve problems. Like it's its own superpower. But I feel like the worst is when you get like entrepreneurial ADHD, where it's like you can't focus on one. One business opportunity. Do you ever have that problem? You're like, oh, I have this great business, but I want to go do this thing.
Yeah, earlier in my career, I would get torn in lots of different directions. And I've learned the older that I've gotten to focus on problems and I can have much bigger outcomes. So I try to stay as focused as I can. I say that, and you know, I'm on the board of a few different companies and I've got real estate company and some other things that I like to dabble with as well. But I try to keep doing the main thing.
So you're guilty is what you said. I understand. I have the same problem. Well, give us the short elevator pitch of Asset Panda and what you guys do. You know, you mentioned that you've been doing this for 12 years. You've got customers in 60 different countries. Tell us a little more about the business.
Yeah. So in another entrepreneurial venture that I had, we had a problem. We kept losing equipment. And we had a really onerous process of trying to audit and track it down and find it. So, you know, going through the process of doing that for my other business, I thought, you know, there's got to be a better way. So I started going under the covers of asset tracking. And I admit it's not the sexiest industry in the world. But the further I got into it, I realized that there were some fundamental issues in the way the market was trying to address asset tracking that I thought there could be a new solution that could address them. So I started the process of, you know, I create mind maps and really kind of go through the concepts and the ideas of the markets that I'm going in. And then I used a couple of different tools to mock up how a mobile app could be used to solve some of the problems, and back and forth, trial and error over a period of time. And voila, out came Asset Panda, which essentially is a highly configurable platform that allows companies to track and manage anything that they own.
So how did the idea change from the beginning? You know, when you started, do you think you were being tracking like IT assets or something, and then ultimately it kind of pivoted, or did the idea stay the same?
No, it pivoted quite a bit. In the beginning, when I was going through that mind map phase, I was mind mapping different markets and the potential of the market. So there was a business to consumer market that I thought was interesting. There's a B2B market that was interesting and a service provider market that was interesting. And when I did the math on all of them, I thought that the biggest market might be for home use. And every one of our insurance policies, it basically tells us that we have to have a list of the details of all the contents of our home if we're going to adjudicate a claim. And, you know, I had a house, had a lot of things in it, and I had an insurance policy, and I didn't have an inventory of the things in my home. And when I talked to people, most people didn't have any sort of tracking, any mechanism at all. So I thought there would be a significant opportunity in the consumer market. But once I got into the consumer market, I realized that the motivation for individuals to actually do it wasn't very significant. And the insurance companies really didn't have much of a motivation for their clients to do it either, because that just meant that there was more provable claims that would come out of the client base. So after trying it for a while, I remember it was a mobile app only focused on consumers. And, you know, it was the first time I ever tried to market a mobile app on a global basis. And I learned a lot about that. You know, when I released the app, I was really kind of giddy and thought, okay, here comes cha-ching on the cash register. We'll have a lot of people download this. I think at the time we were charging maybe $5 a month. And my claim to fame is I had a supermodel in London that downloaded it, would track all of her outfits and jewelry and shoes and things for different photo shoots in it. But I needed like a million more of those for the business to be successful.
Yeah.
So over time, our big break came when the state of Tennessee went from PCs and first responder vehicles to tablets. And we had a local sheriff's department in Tennessee download the application and change living room to squad car and so forth. And we realized pretty quickly that there was a motivation for the corporate world to use a SaaS application and a mobile app for asset tracking. So we pivoted the business and focus primarily on business-to-business transactions. That's almost all of what we do now.
So when you say asset tracking, are you also giving them the ability to print like barcodes or QR codes and put on everything? Like, how do they actually use this?
So they can use it just by the image, and the image can give them a latitude and longitude of exactly where the phone was when it took a picture of the asset. They can scan barcodes, QR codes. They can print those out of Asset Panda, or they can use their own.
Okay. Well, so you mentioned earlier, you know, selling this worldwide. So, you know, tell us, did you initially, was the goal to sell it worldwide, or was it just like, hey, we're going to sell it in the US and Canada, and like then like three random people in England downloaded it? Like how did that go?
Yeah, I mean, in the beginning, we were trying to find a market, and I wasn't too bothered about where the market might be. I assumed it was probably going to be English-speaking countries to begin with, and that assumption proved correct. We had quite a few people in the United States, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, the UK, download and start using the app. And then we started to notice that we had English speakers in other countries start to download and use the app. And then we started noticing that we had some English speakers that also spoke a second language or a third language, and they would incorporate those in with the application itself. So we realized the problem that we were solving wasn't really unique to any geography or country. It was just a human thing. If you're working and you have assets that you use to do your job and you need to track them, it doesn't matter if you're in Europe or China or India or the United States. We all have the same problem, basically.
But making your software support all those countries has its own giant list of issues, right? Like, so at what point in time did you go down the path of like building localization into the software, so it had like different languages and different formats of numbers and different formats of dates? And like people don't realize that even numbers are formatted differently around the world. Like it's India or somewhere where they swap like the periods and the commas are different, or they have, it's not three decimal points per comma or something. Like there's some weird things around the world that most people don't realize.
Absolutely. Also, data privacy too in different countries is very different. So for us, it was just an experience. Like I think a lot of SaaS entrepreneurs, when you find a marketplace, you start to make adjustments to fit the market. So we started out purely as a US-based type application, and then started to add more robust features over time to accommodate local currencies and localization. It's culminating in a release that's coming up for us. The beta came out in February. Globally, it gets released in June. And the latest version of Asset Panda, what we call 2.0, goes a lot further down the road of localization for our customer base. And with the rise of artificial intelligence and a lot of the capabilities that brings, we have artificial intelligence in 2.0, and that makes the language and the formatting that much easier.
Yeah.
And support that much easier for international clients.
So I had a company called Stackify between, I guess, like 2012 and 2021. And then we sold it in 2021. And it was a software product for other software developers to help them track the performance of their software and stuff. Like somebody like your company would have used it. And we had customers similar to you in about 60 different countries. And luckily for us, most software developers around the world speak English, right? So supporting the other languages was not as big of a priority for us, but it would have been better if we did. But like yourself, we had much more success in the countries that had higher English fluency. Like we had quite a few customers in Europe, but there was always, I think, I'm pretty sure if I remember this right, there was one specific country that always stuck out that we could never sell into, and it was France. It's like, for whatever reason, people in France just don't speak English or something. Like it was had like the lowest English fluency in all of Western Europe or something. I don't know. But have you seen like, you know, all these weird patterns of that kind of stuff too?
We have. And a lot of our customers tend to be multinationals. So there are English speakers in different parts of the world with them. And we've noticed the same thing in countries like France, where you tend to find people that do not speak English as a primary or secondary language.
Yeah, that's definitely what we saw. And it was surprising some of the countries we would end up with a lot of customers with. And one of my favorite things of this is we get on a call and we'd be talking to somebody that's using our software and they're talking about the use case. You know, we're just providing, you know, support for them. They're like, yeah, we're the largest bike rental service in Brazil. When people go to swipe their credit card, it's not working. So we downloaded your software to help troubleshoot what was going on. And it's like, that's pretty cool. It's like some giant bike rental service in Brazil. Like, and we had like the largest real estate website in South Africa. And it was like, it was just fascinating to me, like all the different customers we have and all the weird, crazy things that they did. But I'm going to guess your customers do some even weirder things tracking assets.
They do. They when you have the concept of not only tracking the asset, but also managing the asset and then building any kind of custom workflows or triggers around predictive maintenance, that sort of thing, you tend to get some really interesting use cases. And you learn a lot about how different parts of the world work and how different parts of the world economy work. So it's fascinating.
So, I mean, what are some of the weirder things? I mean, you have people that use this to track like military equipment and what are people using this for?
So it's everything from IT equipment to endangered prairie chickens at a zoo to body parts, body fluids, parts for race cars, nuclear waste, military equipment. It really is all the way across the board.
Is there one specific one that always sticks out? It's like, this is the weirdest one ever?
The weirdest one ever? God, there's a bunch of them that I'd say kind of jump to the top. One that's kind of a cool use case is a nonprofit in the UK that uses Asset Panda to track drone submarine vehicles that test the health of the ocean, essentially.
Okay.
And they'll go to different depths and then come up and they'll... via satellite, upload their information, and then that will come into Asset Panda. So that's a really cool one that sticks out. Tracking body parts is also kind of an interesting different use case, one that I never thought of really before we started the company. And then millions of bags of ore, lab equipment. So the list goes on. It's pretty extensive.
Yeah, the two of the ones I always remember from Stackify is we had one that was selling sex machines. Yeah. For whatever reason. Yeah. They were really into performance. Software performance, all the things. So it was like, whatever these people want to do, they sell sex toys and tech, like whatever, I don't care. But that one was always weird. There was definitely some odd ones. But it's like, whatever, you just never know. Like, especially when you're selling SaaS, you don't know the customer. They log. They go to your website. They sign up for a free trial. And they use it. You just don't know. You just have no idea what they're going to do. And especially internationally, you just have no idea what people are going to do. So, but that's part of the fun of it. That's part of my point. Like, I always enjoyed getting on the conversation calls Absolutely. With people and learning about their weird use cases.
Oh yeah. Movie studios tracking parts and props for movies is always one that I kind of geek out about.
Yeah.
I think it's pretty cool.
Yeah. So language is an issue, and you talk about localization. That's one of the problems with selling internationally. How do you do like marketing? Like, what is your go-to-market strategy, you know, in these different countries? Like, do you specifically do marketing, you know, very specifically in different markets, or is it like, we just sort of generically do some stuff and like whoever shows up, or like, how do you do that?
We started out with the generic approach to see who would kind of show up. We, I guess the way we describe it, it's like we're fishing in the ocean. We have a giant net. We're catching all the fish and we're trying to sort them out to figure out which one's the prime fish and which are the, probably aren't the best fit. So for us, it started out as generic. And as we continue to develop and evolve our business model for specific countries and use cases, we're starting to partner with MSPs in local markets. So people that really understand the nuance of so the Greek education system, for example, and speak the language and that are there locally. So through a partner network is how we will continue to envision to grow and expand in international markets.
So does that include, I mean, if you're working for the partners, that definitely helps a lot. But one of the challenges for marketing like this would be the different languages, right? Like if you want to do content on your website, like having your entire website in different languages, you know, creating, you know, ads, like marketing materials, all that kind of stuff. Have you had to deal with that part of it too?
No, for the most part, we keep everything in English and then our partners may use a translator if they want. We have some that take our exact website and they'll convert it into their local language. And that'll be the portal that they use. You know, we are in the process of becoming much more global in terms of how we operate and market. We're still in that area where we're kind of catching all the fish and sorting through them.
Yeah.
As our second version of our platform comes up, we'll be much more intentional about targeting very specific international markets.
Yeah. So at my company, Stackify, our marketing was primarily organic search. So we would write blog posts and, you know, it was really hard to market to software developers, but they'd go to Google and search for things. And if people have a problem, they go to Google. And that's how we had such an international customer base, is our website got up to 10 million website visitors a year through organic search. And it was in literally every country in the world would visit our website every year. And it just got customers from everywhere. Like you said, it's just like sorting the fish. And every once in a while, you'd also catch a giant whale. Right. And but that's part of what made it fun and made it unique. But it's, if you're being really targeted with the marketing, that's where it gets really hard, right? Because, you know, one of the problems we had, and I wonder if you had this problem too, is like, who is your ideal customer, right? So for us, it was like, well, every software development company in the world is our customer. They could all use our tool. Well, if everybody is your customer, then it's like nobody is your customer, right? Because like you have nobody specific to target. So when you guys think about doing marketing, are you focused on like very specific industries, or is it like really just casting a wide net?
So we find that the marketing can be highly effective if you focus on industry use cases, the persona of the person that's actually buying or using your application. And we too leverage content marketing pretty significantly. We crank out quite a few pieces of information that get consumed around the world, just as you were describing.
Yeah, it works really good. And we do that at full scale too. We've published hundreds and hundreds of blog posts, and that drives a lot of business for us. Do remind everybody, if you need help with software development, you can check us out at fullscale.io. And, you know, our team is all in the Philippines. And before we started recording, you mentioned that you have employees in a few different countries because you have customers in a few different countries. And one of the reasons that I originally hired developers in the Philippines back in 2018 was for this exact reason, for Stackify. I had customers all over the world. I needed to do support 24/7. And that was one of the reasons I picked the Philippines, because they were 14 time zones different. And that gave me a big advantage from a support perspective and development perspective. So I'd love to hear your feedback and how this has went for you, being kind of a global employee base too, for the same reasons.
Yeah, it definitely, our motivations were very similar to yours. You know, we had customers all over the world, and we wanted to be able to support them during their business hours. That was the first kind of move to having support both domestically and internationally. And we have people in Europe, we have people in India, we have people in the Philippines, and we have a lot of people in the United States. So we try to follow a 24/7 development environment. And so we're constantly innovating. And the other piece of it is I think you can learn a lot from different markets.
Yeah.
And we've had plenty of customers that have come in from international markets that have taught us something that essentially benefited the entire customer base. So we think that diversity of thought is an important thing as well.
Yeah, I remember there was a time, you know, so our office in the Philippines is in Cebu City, and there was at some point in time we like had a customer at Stackify that was also in the Philippines, like in the same office park. And it's like you guys got to go find them. Like, that's our customer. Like, that's so cool. Like, what are the odds we have a customer in the same office park, 8,000 miles away from here? So, you know, support is definitely an issue, right? Like 24/7 support. You know, that's a huge issue for us. At if your company's all in the U.S., you're like, oh, well, I have a random customer in Singapore or Israel, you know, or, you know, a lot of these other markets, like Australia, especially. Like, we have this problem now with Fullscale. You know, if our sales team is here in Kansas City, like setting up a phone call with somebody in Australia is like worst case scenario, right? It's like, okay, I got to do it at 8 a.m. and that's like 7 p.m. there. Or I got to do it at 8 p.m. Kansas City time, and that's like 7 a.m. there or whatever. Like, it just doesn't work. And so if you're thinking about building a global company, at some point in time, you just have to have employees in other places to do basic sales calls and support calls. And so for us in the early days, that was super painful trying to handle, like, oh, we have these like 3 random clients in Australia or whatever, but it was very difficult to support them. You know, now at Fullscale, of course, we have 300 employees in the Philippines, so it's easy for us to support Australia almost better than anywhere else. But it creates a lot of problems and friction early on. Did you have any specific friction of that, like when you first started? Like, oh, I have all these people that want my help, but we just don't even have anybody to help them?
Yeah, we had a similar experience, and it's one of the driving forces behind having these different support development environments around the world. Same issue. You can handle some of the aggressive time zones for a period of time, but it doesn't leave a great work-life balance for your employees either. So having people around the world definitely really helps.
So what other kind of challenges did you have specifically to kind of operating at a global scale? Like, did you have any issues, like, for example, with payments, like how people pay you?
Yeah, the payment thing wasn't that much of an issue because we used a global credit card processing company from the very beginning. Some of the issues were like latency of our system and making sure they were cached in local servers and markets around the world. So that was an issue. Just the support and the time zones were issues, the language barriers. And I think about the world in my client base as FMPs and PCPs. So fundamental marketplace problems and perfect client profiles, as you were alluding to kind of earlier. And when you have an industry agnostic platform that is global, what you end up happening is you have a series of really good fits that are clients that have fundamental marketplace problems, and it could be by persona or by industry. And then once you identify one and you're able to satisfy that requirement, then that changes how you market to that particular industry. So just matching those FMPs and PCPs, and it's kind of funny because I compare it to like trying to solve a Rubik's Cube sometimes. Because there is so much flexibility. We're basically a no-code, low-code platform. So there's a lot of capability in the system. And then if you have someone that has some gumption to them and they want to learn, it's amazing the different types of business problems our clients have been able to solve with our system. And there's so many, and they're so nuanced to the industry and maybe the geographic location. There's no way I could hire enough people that could, you know, understand it at the level that our clients do. So taking that information, codifying it, understanding it, turning it into actionable content and getting more customers is sort of the name of the game as we grow.
So you refer to it as perfect customer profile, right? People refer to it as ideal customer profile, like you call it a few different things. One day somebody told me something that really stuck with me that I wonder if you've heard that is actually one of my favorite things now, crappiest customer profile. Like being specific about who you don't want as a customer, right? Because one of our problems as entrepreneurs is like, we want everyone as a customer, right? But one of the things we have to force ourselves to do is figuring out like who do we not want as a customer? Like, we have to avoid these people, right? Like, do you have any of those?
We definitely do. You learn over time that there are some use cases and fits that are trying to put a square peg in a round hole kind of thing. So yeah, we definitely, and we try to be as upfront with those people as we can, and we'll refer them to other solutions that might be a better fit for them. We know that clients typically do really well in our system if they have a unique way of working and they want to match that unique way of working in our system. If they don't care and they just want to, you know, use something that's off the shelf, that's quick and easy, then it tends to be a little bit different fit. Our system is, it's easy to use, but there's a lot of capability for configuration. We find the people that get the most value out of the system are the ones that use the configuration.
So I'm going to bring up a topic that I think you're probably going to think is a four-letter word. And maybe you already know where I'm going with this. GDPR.
Oh, yeah.
That's like a dirty four-letter word. You remember that year of your life that you'll never get back?
I do.
So that was one of the fun times for us at Stackify. Is like GDPR is coming out in Europe, all this data privacy stuff, and we have to be all compliant, and we have to go to all of our vendors and get all this report and do all this stuff for GDPR. It almost seems like nobody even cares about it anymore. But if you're doing business internationally, like there's all sorts of this crap all over the world, right?
Yeah, there is. And you got to stay on top of these changes. I do remember when GDPR first came out and everybody was like, what does that mean? And how does it affect our business? We've got some pretty good partners that are third parties that do audits for us and help make sure that we're compliant with things like GDPR. So it hasn't become a significant issue. As a matter of fact, it's more of an afterthought now because everything is in place.
Yeah.
And, you know, I respect the reasons why those types of standards are in place. But yeah, I mean, when they first come out, it can be a pretty scary, you know, set of circumstances to try to figure out what it is and make sure you're compliant.
I mean, the good news is most of the best practices are kind of relatively the same. So it's, you know, be it the state of California's weird rules or GDPR or Australia or Germany or whoever it is, they're all relatively kind of similar. But
yeah.
But have you guys also had to deal with like where your data center is and hosting their data, you know, in their country? Have you guys had to deal with that part of it?
We have. Most of our data hosting is still in the United States. So if there is a client, sometimes they'll come in and say it has to be hosted in Scotland or wherever. And that's a good example of a client that's probably not the greatest fit for us. And the second version of our application, we'll have a lot more freedom and we'll be hosting data in other countries, but we haven't done that to date.
And this is a topic that I'm sure most people don't think is a trivial decision, but if you go to like your software development team and you're like, hey, you have to, you know, have multiple data centers now. Okay, good luck. Let me know when you're done.
Yeah.
Next sprint, right? Like, yeah. It is not a trivial decision. Like, it is this monster giant technology change to support multiple countries. And now you're like, well, do we have multiple billing systems now? Or do I have one billing system, but I have like data hosted multiple places, and then what happens if I need to move the data that's in the US to now the data center in Germany? Like there's like this infinite Pandora's box that you open once you try and support multiple data centers. So we never did that.
We've noticed that. So we partner with AWS for most of our hosting. And what's fascinating about this industry is the problems that you just described that you had are the same problems I have and the same problem that probably every other SaaS company has. So these big cloud providers are working on solutions that help us just like they'd help you. So we've noticed quite a few advancements with AWS that make that kind of thing easier. Still not easy, but easier than it was before.
It's definitely a very common problem. And every one of these countries are getting stricter and stricter about data privacy stuff. And obviously in the US right now, the whole big debate around TikTok and, you know, the data there potentially, you know, going into China and all of that. And, you know, we're still seeing more and more of that, but it adds so much complexity to somebody who's listening right now. They're like, oh, I'd love to build a SaaS product and sell it internationally to 180 countries. It's like, man, there's like landmines everywhere potentially if you want to be compliant in all 180 countries.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's a daunting task. The way that we looked at it is we took the top 27 markets globally, and we started to just check off the list with the biggest marketplaces and just kind of go down the list of making sure we're compliant in each one of those. If it's outside of that, then our response will be, this is what we do. We're SOC 2 compliant, for example, and we follow GDPR and data privacy standards. But if it's very specific to a small country somewhere, we'll just say, this is our standard. And if you like it, that's what we'll go with.
So we have this relatively easy compared to, say, somebody like Uber. Can you imagine the legal nightmares of somebody like Uber in all these different countries?
It's fascinating. A quick Uber story for you. When Uber first came out, I was on a trip to South Africa with my son, and we wanted to see where Nelson Mandela had lived for a period of time in Swetatown. So we were dropped off by our hotel. I had used Uber maybe 3 or 4 times in the United States. It was still kind of a new thing. And there was no way to get a hold of someone to pick us up. So my son looked at me and said, Dad, why don't you try the Uber app? And it was crazy to watch the pin move Dallas, Texas, all the way to Johannesburg. And we had a rider in like 8 minutes. And I thought, okay, when Uber comes out, I'm buying their stock.
You know, so I've been to the Philippines a lot of times, you know, full scale. We have a lot of employees there. I go there a lot. There is no Uber in the Philippines. There's something called Grab and there's something called Ancas. And one of the funny challenges I had with, I believe it was Ancas, is I couldn't download the Ancas app because your phone had to be in the Philippines, like country, like mode to even download the app. Like the app was restricted that you could only download it if, you know, the phone was registered in the Philippines. So like as a tourist or whatever coming into the Philippines, like I couldn't even download the app.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Like that was like its own crazy problem for me. Let me ask you this. You mentioned you had employees in several different countries. Have you dealt with like labor law and all that kind of stuff, like setting up subsidiaries in different countries and having employees in different countries or dealing with that part of it?
Yes, we've definitely gone down the road of dealing with labor issues and that sort of thing. And it's not easy. You know, there are so many nuances just between the United States and Canada, for example. It's like two different, radically different worlds. So, when we employ people in different countries, we tend to use a third-party service through the employment now and try to outsource that as much as possible.
Yeah, so these companies like Deel, and there's like 100 of them now that are like employment of record companies.
Right.
That make it so much easier to hire like one random employee in one random country. But I think even on some of those, like even if they make it easy to say, let's say hire somebody in the Philippines, you still end up having to follow the laws. You're like, well, you can't just fire this person. Like you still have to follow the local labor laws, even though you hired them like through this thing. So have you had to deal with some weird labor laws?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. From time to time, something that like that will come up. And then we learn a lot about the local labor laws. Thankfully, we've been established in the countries that we're in long enough where we've gotten across those hurdles. But we've felt that pain point for sure.
So what is the weirdest labor law you've run into?
The weirdest one? Okay, so you hire an employee, they start working for you for a period of time, and then they just disappear. And you can't just simply part ways with them. In some circumstances, there were 5-6 month periods where we had to continue to essentially pay the employee even though we weren't in contact with them. So we've had that sort of issue before, and then just localized insurance issues and that sort of thing.
I had breakfast with a guy this morning. I had employees in the Philippines that they're the labor board. It's called DOLE. And he fired some people for the exact same reason you just described. They like no called, no showed a whole bunch of times. And so he fired them and they sued him with a labor case and he lost the labor case. And it's like the people just didn't show up to work. and somehow I lost the labor case. Like,
been there.
How is that possible?
I don't get it, but I respect the local labor laws of these different countries, and I think there's a reason for it, even though I may not understand the reason. So we do everything we can to make sure.
Yeah.
We do everything by the book.
It's definitely very different from one country to another. From like in India, when somebody quits a job, they usually give like 2 months notice. You know, it's like so fascinating when you start dealing with international labor.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what other kind of interesting things have you run into having an international business?
I think, so managing the expectation of the customer in their local market, the nuance of each local market, just like we talk about specific labor laws, we notice that different organizations, although they might be virtually identical in a lot of ways, operate very differently based on the local requirements. So in the United States, for example, schools have different grant funding and things that they have to adhere to that are very different than in the Netherlands or France or Germany and other areas. So just trying to understand their mode of operation and what's important to them is a challenge internationally. And once you understand it, or you have a partner that understands it, things tend to be quite a bit smoother. But we've noticed that one size doesn't fit all for the labor portion of it, and also for just the operating metrics.
So tell us a little more about your partnership program, because it sounds like that's really critical to your company growth, and you've got partners all around the world. So What is it like working with these partners all around the world?
It's a lot of fun, and it's very helpful for us as a business. We call it our MSP program. And essentially, partners in different parts of the world will sign up to sell into a market. And more often than not, the MSP will have a very specific mandate. Let's say they focus on government institutions, or they focus on mining, or they focus on schools. So we find that we can get quite a bit more penetration in markets if we work with a local provider. And for us, you know, there's two different ways to get customers. It's either, you know, catching everyone in that big net that we were talking about earlier and sorting through them, or we can work with an MSP partner and really support them and become a critical part of their business. So working with MSPs allows us to have local support, local implementation, local renewal. So it relieves our company of quite a bit of the burden of supporting the customer while giving the customer a much better experience. And on the other side, we're helping an MSP continue to build up their business and their profitability and their stickiness within their clients. So we want our MSPs to be incredibly successful in penetrating the market, and we'd prefer to work with an MSP the vast majority of the time if we're in an international market.
Yeah, because it also makes your clients more successful, right? Like, instead of your clients trying to figure it all out, now they have a local partner that can really help them get the most value out of your system.
Absolutely.
So it creates a nice win-win. And those are the partnerships that work the best. Like, it's really hard when it's like, if your partner is like, I don't really get much out of doing this thing, so like, why do I do this? Yeah. Where if it's like, hey, our whole business is based on using Asset Panda, and then, you know, we provide a bunch of value added, you know, services above what it does. And so it's a win-win.
Absolutely. That's the way we look at it. We want to be the backbone of their business and help them be successful entrepreneurs. And we find it's a pretty good marriage.
Well, I really appreciate having you on the show today. This has been awesome talking about having a global SaaS company and some of the issues you have to think through. Sounds like we both have been through it. We both have a few battle scars probably from all of it. But overall, I would say it's was a lot of fun. It was really cool. And my favorite thing was always talking to all the international customers and all the weird different things that they did, don't you think?
Yeah, I see it the same way. The world's a fascinating place. It's a big place, a lot of interesting people in it. And it makes life more interesting in the business to touch these different markets and remember that we're all humans. We're all on this planet. We come from different countries, and that's okay. But we're all just people.
So does that mean you get to write off any kind of international business trip? Like you could infinite international business expenses now, right?
We do have clients all over the place, and we do a lot of we do a fair amount of in-person touch with
them. Yeah.
So we do end up spending some time on the road, and that makes it hard with the family, you know, long rides and all that. But we like having a presence with our customers in different countries.
That's a fun perk of it. So, all right. Well, once again, this is Rex Curzius, founder and CEO of Asset Panda. You can check him out at assetpanda.com. Rex, thank you so much for doing this today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Matt.
Thank you.
Startup Hustle is brought to you by Fullscale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. Make sure you reach down and hit that subscribe button, then come find us on Instagram. See you next time. We do it.